Dr. Lipton commented on the crucial role played by Dr. Robert Marks in the identification of the syndrome of ONJ, or osteonecrosis of the jaw. I met with Dr. Marks to hear this fascinating story, which began just a few years ago.
Essentially, as a clinical oral and maxillofacial surgeon, we see a number of patients who come in with jawbone problems, for lack of a better term. And being a referral institution, we began to notice in about late 1999, early 2000, a number of people coming to us who had exposed bone and then developed secondary infections. We noticed a peculiarity to it in that if we went to do surgical debridements, which is the classic in our profession, to just debride dead bone, you'd expect healing to occur and the bone to cover. It didn't happen. In fact, we made it worse. We began to develop a critical number of patients and then look back in a retrospective fashion what these individuals had in common. And the only thing they had in common, they were receiving at that time mainly Iridia and a few Zometa. And it just dawned on us that there was something related to the bisphosphonates that were relatively new on the marketplace.
And these were cancer patients?
Initially, they were all cancer patients, metastatic breast cancer patients, and multiple myeloma.
What was the next step after that?
The next step after that is that I personally contacted Novartis, who was the manufacturer of both Iridia and Zometa, as I think everyone knows, and alerted them to this complication. Peter Tarasoff and another representative came by with interest. They visited two or three of my patients. I showed them directly, and we chatted about that. Their response was fundamentally well and good, but pretty much did not attribute it to their medications. They felt it was due to the chemotherapy instead, and that it was due to the dexamethasone that about only 55% were on. And so it proceeded from there to other colleagues of mine reporting some of these cases. We published a medical alert in the Journal of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery in September of 2003. Followed shortly thereafter by a colleague of mine in New York, Saul Ruggiero, who published 63 cases, probably about 5-6 months later. And that seemed to spur Novartis to convene a panel of experts. And so we had several meetings, and that generated a position paper.
What did that say?
I was a little bit disappointed with the position paper, frankly, and withdrew from it twice, only put my name on it the third time because I felt that it was important to at least get the message out. It basically reviewed that there is exposed bone that occurs very rarely with this entity, that the exposed bone is difficult to heal, and that it's a compilation of chemotherapy, dexamethasone, and other comorbidities. It was so heavily weighted toward the comorbidities and didn't put the real responsibility on the bisphosphonates that I was disappointed in it. It was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology.
And the initial report you had, how many cases were that?
Well, the initial report that came out as a medical alert in our journal was just 36 cases. And then in November of 2005, we reported 119 cases.
So sort of fast-forwarding to the present, at this point, what do we understand about the pathophysiology of this entity?
Well, the pathophysiology is directly related to the dose and the time of exposure of any bisphosphonate, including some of the oral bisphosphonates. Now, the IV bisphosphonates, Zometa and Iridia, are absorbed directly into the mineral matrix of bone, and they inhibit the enzyme farnesyl synthetase, which is required by the osteoclast for basic survival. So it all has to do with osteoclast downregulation and apoptosis.
And how does that lead to this entity? And when was the actual term osteonecrosis of the jaw coined, and who coined it?
It probably was me coining it, and it was coined initially in early 2004. The first reports, we thought it was an avascular necrosis, and when we started getting information about the action of the bisphosphonates, we knew it was due to the osteoclast downregulation. So it became an osteonecrosis in early 2004.
And can you talk a little bit more about exactly what's going on inside the bone and how that translates into the clinical presentation?
Yeah, I mean, that is easy. One of the things I think the medical oncologists need to know from this is that the other bones are not so severely affected. What is unique about the mandible and maxilla is the presence of teeth or the wearing of dentures. Good studies have shown that the bone in the tooth-bearing areas of the jaws that we call the alveolar bone remodels 10 times faster than any other adult bone. So therefore, there's a 10 times greater vulnerability of the bone around the teeth. Then you add to it the ubiquitousness of dental disease like decay and gum disease, and we call periodontal disease, and you add increased inflammation, increase the turnover even more. So if you have a drug like Zometa and Aridia that affect the osteoclast, which is involved with bone turnover, the bone cannot turn over. Osteocytes live essentially for 150 to 180 days. They die literally of a terminal lifespan, and they're not renewed and replaced. And so the osteoclast, when it resorbs bone, we know releases insulin-like growth factors 1 and 2 and bone morphogenetic protein. This, in turn, stimulates and causes a differentiation of stem cells into osteoblasts, and you reform your bone.
So I guess I must have studied this in med school, but I can't quite remember it. You're saying that the osteoclasts lead to osteoblast formation?
Oh, yes, yes. When an osteoblast forms bone initially, it imparts into the mineral matrix of bone, bone morphogenic proteins, and insulin-like growth factors 1 and 2. Now, these are acid-insoluble peptides. So when an osteoclast comes along and resorbs bone in a normal physiologic fashion, it recognizes the bone by certain chemical signals of bone either dying or being dead in the first place. So an osteoclast resorbs bone with hydrochloric acid within the Hauschild lacunae. It releases the BMP. The BMP and insulin-like growth factors then attach to the cell membranes of stem cells that are in the local area. They're converted into osteoblasts, and the bone renews itself.
Are you saying it sort of has a garbage pickup type feature? It's sort of clearing it out?
It's a feedback loop type of a thing. In fact, the reformation of bone, like I said, occurs in normal adults about every 150 to 180 days. It's called a sigma in bone physiologic terms. So you interrupt this renewal cycle, and you end up with bone that outlives its lifespan, ends up dying off. The blood vessels involute because the osteocytes are dead, the osteoblasts are dead, and you get bone that becomes exposed.
There's a mucosa. What happens to that that covers it?
Well, the overlying mucosa, or gum tissue as often called, its blood supply is dependent on the underlying bone. So when the bone dies off, the overlying mucosa essentially also undergoes a necrosis. The bone becomes exposed.
Now, what sort of dental histories did these patients have or problems that they have? Was that directly correlated with where it occurs?
The answer there is yes and no. The most common place is the lower jaw in the back part, the molar area. And that has to do with the bite force characteristics. When everybody bites down on either food or during your swallowing process, you put pressure on your teeth. The greatest pressure is in the lower jaw in the molar area. And this is what makes the jaw vulnerable to anything that affects the osteoclast, from intravenous bisphosphonates to even oral bisphosphonates, in that the bone has to adjust to this bite pressure. So it resorbs and renews itself on a more rapid basis to accommodate the pressure forces of the chewing cycle and the swallowing cycle and all the pressures we put on it day to day.
So it doesn't have to have any pathophysiologic problem in terms of a dental problem. It just can be normal biting?
Yes. In fact, about 30% occur spontaneously in people who do not have an underlying dental pathogenesis. Now, the other side of that coin, obviously, is that people who do have inflammation from dental decay, from abscessed teeth, from gum disease called periodontal disease, increases the rate of bone turnover. And therefore, you get a higher percentage of people developing bone exposures who have those underlying dental problems.
And what are the typical clinical presentations?
The most common presentation is exposed bone. That's the very definition of bisphosphonate-induced osteonecrosis. In fact, every organization has come up with a definition. And most definitions go something like this. The presence of exposed bone in the oral cavity that fails to heal over 8 weeks and has not been associated with local radiation therapy. The onset of it is sometimes asymptomatic. About one-third of the patients are asymptomatic because the exposed bone is necrotic, it's de-innervated, it's not necessarily painful. Two-thirds are painful because of secondary infection.
Does the pain usually respond to antibiotics?
Fortunately, it does. We've been able to control this in 90% of individuals with relatively simple antibiotics. The bacteria associated with this are almost always anaerobes. Anaerobes seem to use open necrotic bone as a substrate even more than aerobes. So most of the organisms that we have found are actinomyces, Eicinella, Villanella, and Moraxella. These are all types of anaerobes. All of them are sensitive to penicillin.
So that's the usual therapy?
Yeah, fortunately, the best therapy is what's called penicillin VK. The advantage to it is that it is easy to take, has very little gastric disturbance. Some of the other penicillin preparations that have clavulanate and sulbactam in it to increase their spectrum have a gastric intolerance to them that is difficult long-term. Penicillin VK, 500 milligrams four times a day, can be taken for long terms without toxicity. So if you're not allergic to penicillin, that is a drug of choice and controls most people.
How long does it usually take to see pain response, and how long does it take to go away?
The pain response, once it develops, if you're taking the penicillin regularly, it's subdued within a week. There's a relatively quick response.
What about those patients who don't respond to antibiotics?
Well, very few don't. If they don't respond to penicillin by itself, our backup position is to combine flagyl to it. And that flagyl is at 500 milligrams three times a day. So for short periods, we will give them double antibiotic therapy, and that tends to put it back into a non-painful subclinical fashion. For the penicillin-allergic patients, out of just empirical trial and error, we found that Levaquin is the best alternative to penicillin, 500 milligrams once daily.
How well informed are oral surgeons in this country about this entity?
Probably informed more than any other dental specialty, but there are still many that are not well informed. This particular disease spans, I think, three groups. The general dental population who restores and fixes teeth. The oral and maxillofacial surgeon who probably understands the disease process and who inherits these patients more. And then the medical community of oncologists, rheumatologists, and the like are starting to recognize that this is something that is rare but can occur. And when it does, it needs attention. And there's a lot of prevention that can be done for this.
What's the differential diagnosis of other common entities that cause exposed bone, if any?
There are three others that should be considered. In fact, I have a lecture we call bone rot that cause exposed bone almost exclusively in the jaws. The number one to distinguish it from is osteoradionecrosis. Now, if a person has exposed bone in the mouth and has had 6,000 centigrade or more radiation and may also be taking a bisphosphonate, it's most likely due to the radiation. And that's why the definitions exclude anybody with local radiation. Osteoradionecrosis has been something the profession of oral surgery has dealt with for decades, and we have good protocols for that. The second one is just bacterial osteomyelitis will cause exposed bone. Bacterial osteomyelitis presents a little different fashion. We can distinguish that by clinical experience. The next one, essentially, is what's called osteopetrosis. And that's interesting in a genetic analog to the bisphosphonate problem. Because that disease entity is a genetic absence or dysfunction of osteoclasts. And that led us to determine that the osteoclast really was the pivotal cell in this disease process.
Fascinating. How many cases are there of that in the United States, for example?
Well, osteopetrosis, also called marble bone disease or Albers-Schoenberg's disease, has eight variations to it. It's very uncommon. I think it's an instance of a one out of every 10,000 births.
What's the clinical course of ONJ?
Well, the clinical course is the development of exposed bone. It usually takes, if you're talking about Aridia and Zometa, from Zometa it takes to get into the risk range of about 8 to 12 doses. Aridia a little bit slower, we see about 10 to 14 doses before people develop exposed bone.
When you say risk range, once you get into those doses, what kind of risk are you looking at?
Well, that's the risk for exposed bone. That's the dose accumulation that we run into a risk. And so as it is pertinent to the dental community, the oral surgeon, is that if we accomplish an invasive dental procedure, that has a risk of not healing and developing exposed bone, which can parlay itself literally into losing half of your jaw. So our experience has been when somebody gets exposed bone, a lot of times they're confused about it. They need a little bit of education themselves. So we educate the patient what it is. Essentially, we tell them that it's likely to be permanent and that even discontinuing a drug is not going to necessarily resolve this. The good news on this, if there is such a thing, is that the exposed bone by itself is not painful, that we can control their pain with simple antibiotics and an antiseptic mouthwash called Peridex. So that's our initial baseline therapy. Most people respond to that, and they live with exposed bone, literally. They function normally. The risk for fracture is very little, simply because there's an overbuilding of strength to the jaw. Unless it is part of a surgery removed, there's not much of a risk for fracture.
How large are these lesions?
Some of them involve either the whole jaw or half the jaw. Some of them are very large, 7, 8, 10 centimeters.
And the patient feels it with their finger or tongue that it's open?
Yes, yes.
But yet it's not painful?
It's not painful unless it becomes secondarily infected.
So a patient then, over a period of 2 or 3 or 4 years with this, how often would they require antibiotics?
Some patients require it ongoing, and that's one of the values of penicillin therapy is. It can be given ongoing with very little secondary problems. Some of them take it intermittently. We will have them take the antibiotic when they have exacerbations of pain. Squelches the pain down, then they go on for a period of time with a pain-free state and only retake it should the pain return.
Interesting. You know, I guess one of the things that's going to be interesting is, I mean, it's one thing when you talk about using bisphosphonates for metastatic solid tumors, which, you know, usually are not curable. Certainly breast cancer isn't. But we're waiting right now on a big NSABP study of cladrinate to see whether they can confirm whether bisphosphonates work as adjuvant therapy. And I guess if that turns out to be positive, which would be a great thing in terms of reducing relapse rate, now we're looking at patients who are cured who might, I don't know what the duration of bisphosphonates is going to be, but you're saying if they get above 8 or 12 courses, what's the incidence at that point?
That's a very good question. The incidence is unknown. We've got studies that report as little as 0.8%, but that was a Novartis-sponsored study, I might add, to as much as 12%, controlled studies out of Italy that showed an incidence of about 12%. I think the reality is probably somewhere in between, about 6 to 8% in our opinion, based not on reading any hard data.
I mean, 6 to 8% for the condition as you're describing it and not going away is not too good.
Not too good, but the good news here, it's controllable. 90% of our patients, and now we're looking at 143 patients so far, are living with exposed bone, eating relatively normally, out of pain, and functioning as they did prior to the exposed bone. That's been a pretty good success.
Is it possible to determine sort of whether diagnosing it early helps, you know, or is it just sort of all of a sudden show up maybe with half the jaw involved?
There is some early radiographic signs that we see in the jaws. It's called widening of the periodontal membrane space that's around the teeth. We see a sclerosis around the teeth. If you look at the action of the bisphosphonates, fundamentally, they inhibit bone resorption. And so if you inhibit bone resorption, you build up old bone, which is more mineralized. And so X-ray-wise or radiographically, you see hypermineralization of bone. In fact, for Fosamax and Actinel and all the oral bisphosphonates, that's the measure of their therapeutic benefit, an increase in bone mineral density. And so you see increases in bone mineral density with these.
Is it possible to sort of come up with a trade-off in terms of trying to minimize the risk but maximize particularly the benefit in terms of metastatic disease? Let's talk about metastatic breast cancer, for example. I've heard oncologists say, you know, maybe I'm not going to use a bisphosphonate if a patient just has one or two bone mets, sort of minimal sort of bone involvement because of their concern about this. Does that make sense or not really?
I don't think it makes sense. If there's a message we want to get out, it is to the medical oncologists, and I say this to the patients, is that, look, the bisphosphonates have been beneficial for you. Prior to the bisphosphonates, patients with your diagnosis suffered fractures, suffered bone resorption, hypercalcemia, a number of other complications that often led to severe disability and even death. And so on balance, these drugs have been good for you. If there's anything we want to tell you is that with some education of medical oncologists and dentists, we can prevent most of this. And if you do develop it, we can treat this and we can manage it. We may not be able to cure it, but we can manage it, that you can lead a pretty normal life and still have the benefits of this drug.
What about prevention? Can you go through that?
That's the easiest thing to do, but it's going to take the most education. If there's a message I'd want to give to the oncologist is that when you do recognize somebody, any patient who you feel requires a bisphosphonate that has metastatic disease, refer them right away to a dentist who is familiar with this. Probably start with the oral and maxillofacial surgeon who can direct the care. And so the message there is to the oncologist is don't be intimidated by this ONJ stuff that you don't give the patient a valuable drug called zomedoneridia. Number two, but also refer them to a dentist who is familiar with this. Now, we asked the dentist, here's what we want you to do. the medical oncologist, if you can, defer your bisphosphonate for about 2 months, which is physiologically feasible. From cancer kinetics, I think that's not asking anything that's inappropriate. The dentist needs to begin right away to do one fundamental thing. Take care of the mouth to avoid dental extractions or dental implant later on. And so what they need to do is to get the mouth in optimum health. So I tell the dentist or the oral surgeon, give everybody a thorough examination. Take out any teeth that are abscessed, not restorable, failing root canals. To do all of the invasive work while the bone is capable of healing through a remodeling process. And then begin preventative dentistry. In other words, crowns, bridges, dentures, fillings are feasible anytime during the bisphosphonate exposure because that's not invasive.
What about doing this type of work while patients are on chemotherapy?
Not too much of a problem. With chemotherapy does affect healing, but the mouth is gifted with a blood supply and immune response that generally handles that pretty well.
Do you try to sort of avoid periods of low white counts or give growth factors when this type of work is being done?
Yeah, somebody who's on chemotherapy, and that's why I think the oral and maxillofacial surgeon is probably the center point who understands this. Yes, if somebody's in the middle of chemotherapy, we do want to take our blood tests. And if somebody is nadiring down to a really low white count, you want to defer that until they're into a period where their white count is at least 3,000. We often use platelet-rich plasma to help healing and other growth factors to help your healing process.
I've mentioned to you before, we do a lot of patterns of care studies of oncologists, and we've never asked these questions. I'd like to. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Alan Lipton about trying to see what oncologists are doing. But I'm going to bet what you just described in terms of prevention and you know, holding off on the bisphosphonates for 2 months and sending the patient for this work, et cetera, I'm going to bet that it's not done that much.
No, it isn't done. Right now, that is the challenge. There's an educational requirement out there. Not only to my dental colleagues, and I have to address myself, my oral surgery colleagues, and the general dentistry colleagues, which are much more numerous, because they see the patients first many times, and how to recognize it, how to educate their patients, and then what to do with these people. And then, of course, the medical oncologists who, one, as I've said, recognize that there is a risk factor, how to refer them to a dentist. Number three, not be intimidated by the spectrum of ONJ to go ahead and treat these patients. Because the dental community's message to the medical oncologists is treat these patients as you always would, but let us take care of the mouth situation. We can handle that. We have protocols that we can deal with it and manage it. Because you can deal with exposed bone in the mouth. You can't deal with runaway cancer.
Do the NCCN guidelines incorporate what you just described?
Not to my knowledge, simply because this is all very new. This is something that was never known before 2003. Met resistance until probably late 2005. So now we're into a year where it's been recognized as a real entity. And typically what's happened is that lawyers have entered into the scheme and mixed this up. The drug companies are in a protective mode because they're being challenged by attorneys and patients with lawsuits.
Wow.
And so they're not too free with some information. And so that's complicated the issue. But the basic message is there are some positive things you should do with a patient before they start a bisphosphonate, while they're on it, and then when they get exposed bone. So there's three time frames that we are concerned about.
The recommendations that you just described, are those your individual thoughts, or does that represent sort of the oral surgery community in general?
They represent the oral surgery community in general. My parent organization, the American Association of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgeons, has published a position guideline paper that includes most of this. And eight other specialties of dentistry have their own position papers that mimic pretty much what I've just said.
Fascinating. What about the manpower? Is it out there? I mean, we're talking about a lot of patients who would require an awful lot of work the way you just described it, I would assume. I don't know what the number is. I'm sure tens of thousands of people.
Well, if you assume a 10% incidence of this occurring, and probably it'll increase as more people are using these drugs, and you're maybe 500,000 people in the United States, I believe, have been estimated to take either Zometa or Ritia.
500,000 cancer patients?
Cancer patients are receiving those.
Wow.
So 10% of 500,000. However, yes, there's plenty of dentists out there. The real problem is educating them to also be not intimidated by these patients.
Now, what about the duration of bisphosphonates? I mean, right now, patients are being kept on this indefinitely. Do you agree with that?
Personally, no. And I'm not a medical oncologist. I'm just a bone scientist. The bisphosphonates get absorbed into bone and have a half-life of over 10 years. In fact, thought to be infinity. And so why are we giving a drug that already has its therapeutic effect inset in the first few doses? Why do we continue to give it? I'm not sure. And the research never really challenged that. Now, I understand that Novartis is sponsoring protocols now of more intermittent dosing, once every 3 months, once every 6 months, then once every month.
So understanding that it'd be great to have clinical research looking at this, but who knows when that's going to happen. Any gut feeling for what the interval should be and the duration?
It is a gut feeling, and you know, I preface it with that. There's no hard data. I think Novartis is on the right track, that a once every 6 month dosing, and I'm extrapolating this from what we've learned about the oral bisphosphonates, that intermittent dosing will balance a reduction in the incidence of this ONJ and still maintain the benefit of preventing metastatic deposits in bone from resorbing bone significantly.
So you're saying every 6 months from the beginning, or monthly for a while and then every 6 months?
Every 6 months from the beginning.
Wow. And you're saying that regardless of the volume of metastatic disease, that it ought to be done?
That's probably not for me to say. That's a clinical judgment I think only the oncologist can make. That's getting out of my area of expertise. From just strictly an extrapolation basis, the larger the amount of metastatic deposit bone, the initial dosing probably should be higher at first.
Any estimate on how decreasing the interval or increasing the interval, let's say, for example, to 6 months, might affect the risk of ONJ?
Unstudied. What we have found is an extrapolation from the oral bisphosphonates. So if I could just digress to that just a bit. We don't see individuals develop problems with Fosamax until they're on it for 3 years. And this is kind of a proof that the bisphosphonates caused a problem, not any chemotherapy, simply because we have now 35 cases just due to oral bisphosphonates alone. 32 Fosamax, 3 Actonel, none Boniva as yet.
And that's just your cases?
Just my own cases. Plus, I'm aware of at least 200-300 from colleagues who have talked to me or emailed me.
But so not published?
In press right now.
Wow. Okay.
Now, what we found with those is that you don't have a risk for this osteonecrosis until you've been on an oral bisphosphonate for 3 years. And that the most cases occur with 5 years or more. So it's a dose accumulation. Now, when you take Zometa, 4 milligrams, all 4 milligrams IV gets absorbed into your bone instantly. It has that much affinity for the bone. If you take one 10-milligram pill of Fosamax, say, only 0.63 milligrams get absorbed into your bone. That's the bioavailability. So what you get in an oral bisphosphonate is a trickle effect into your bone, and it starts down-regulating the osteoclast. What happens and why it doesn't really affect individuals until they've been out for 3 to 5 years is that the bone marrow is able to keep pace by new osteoclast precursors. And so it's this relatively large initial dose that decimates the osteoclast and then exhausts the osteoclast precursors over time. Because the big difference between intravenous bisphosphonate osteonecrosis and oral, if you undergo a drug holiday from Fosamax for 6 months, the bone heals or lends itself to a minor office-based surgical debridement, indicating that the osteoclasts are able to repopulate. You do the same thing with an IV bisphosphonate, stopping the drug, and this is the other message to the medical oncologist. Stopping Zometa or Ridia does not benefit oral exposed bone to any great degree. And so if the benefits still are there for the cancer patient, don't hesitate to continue the medication.
That's interesting. So you're saying that the patient develops ONJ, they have metastatic bone disease, maybe multiple sites of bone mets. You're saying to continue the bisphosphonate?
If the medical oncologist feels that it's still benefiting the patient from a cancer perspective, continue on. Again, we can manage the oral exposed bone. You can't manage the runaway cancer. So if it's still benefiting the cancer, go ahead and continue the medication. There's no absolute reason to stop it.
What do you think the message is right now about that? What do you think is being done in practice in these rare cases? I'm guessing they stop it.
Yes. Again, that's an intuitive thing that medical oncologists are taking because our message hasn't gotten out to everybody yet.
That's interesting. Has anyone looked at what's happened to these patients in terms of bone complications? You would guess they kind of go back to the old days where they're having hypercalcemia and lots of problems. In other words, these cases of ONJ, the few hundred cases that are out there, Most of these people have had their bisphosphonate stopped, I assume.
No, many of them. I can only speak about my patients.
Your patients,
that I have a direct
you're encouraging your oncologist to keep it going.
Yeah, we do. But many of them have stopped it for a good term. Our initial impression is that the metastatic deposits have stayed static, that people who've been off it for a year or two have been followed up by their medical oncologists. The metastatic deposits have stayed static, and their bone in the jaws has not worsened or developed new sites, but it has not healed.
But in terms of metastatic bone disease, did I understand you to say that after a certain period of time, the bisphosphonates just get in the bone and they're going to stay in the bone? And, you know, would that sort of imply that maybe there'd be protection in terms of metastatic disease, even without it on board?
Yes, it would. If you look at it from a pharmacologic standpoint, the Zometa you took 5 years ago is still in that same bone.
But on the other hand, your bone's different because you have metastatic disease in it and things are happening in the bone. Would the bisphosphonates protect against progressive metastatic bone disease in that situation?
In theory, they would, yes.
Interesting. What about the patient who is on a bisphosphonate? You mentioned preventive procedures in that situation.
Well, this is in the realm of the dentist and the oral surgeon that we've advised our colleagues that when a patient comes into your office and your medical history identifies that they have been on a bisphosphonate, either oral or an IV bisphosphonate, is, of course, document that in your history. But then your goal there is to do non-invasive dental work. For the intravenous bisphosphonates, we do not advise dental implants. That could end up with exposed bone and significant complications.
Can you talk a little bit more about what implants are and when they're done?
Dental implants have been the big revolution in dentistry today. In 1980, dental implants came on the marketplace and have become exceedingly popular. So if you lose a tooth, instead of having a bridge where other teeth are cut down or a removable denture, you can have a dental implant, which is a titanium cylinder, looks like a tooth root. It's placed into your bone, and then the bone grows into it, a process called osseointegration. Now, that's a metabolic bone process that requires bone healing and bone turnover, and so it's vulnerable to anything that affects bone healing. After about 6 months, the bone has locked that implant in so tightly that you can have a tooth placed on it, chew on it in normal fashion, and it is the closest thing to a normal tooth replacement that's available today.
And what about people who already have had implants and are going to be started on bisphosphonates?
Well, that's the group that the dentist needs to follow closely. There's no contraindication to that. It has to be followed, but that group is vulnerable to developing bone problems around the implant, but no more than around the natural tooth.
What are some of the other issues that you think are important for oncologists to know about? And I should mention this incredible book that you just handed me, Oral and Intravenous Bisphosphonate-Induced Osteonecrosis of the Jaws, that you wrote. It's an awesome book. We're going to put the specifics about who published it and how to get a hold of it in the booklet that goes with this audio program. But what are some of the other messages you'd like to see get out to medical oncologists?
The messages are a couple I've already mentioned. One is treat your patients as you normally would. But this is probably the time where medicine and dentistry needs to get together more so than they've ever done before, in that you need to develop a cadre of dentists whom you trust that you can refer to simply because the medications you give do have complications that are represented in the mouth, and that you need to develop a little knowledge of what they do and their problems, and they need to understand your problems. So medical oncologists, continue to treat your patients as you would. Do it a little bit more in concert with dentists and oral and maxillofacial surgeons. If your patient develops exposed bone, one, don't be surprised. Two, don't discontinue the medication if you feel it's still benefiting your patient. If you feel it's not, then don't ever give a patient something that is not benefiting them. That's almost common sense. And refer them to an oral and maxillofacial surgeon who can manage it. And that managed situation can go on for a long period of time.
How often do you think this entity occurs and is not diagnosed, is not noticed by the patient or doctor?
Well, I think back in 2002, 03, and 04, a lot. Right now, the dental community and oral surgery community has been alerted to it that very few of them are going on undiagnosed. In fact, we see some of the reverse. We see some diagnosed of that actually represent other problems. I think we all need to kind of go back to the research board and do more studies. We really need to know if intermittent dosing of an IV bisphosphonate is going to prevent this entity from occurring. It likely can, but that hasn't yet to be shown.
Right,
Instead of once a month, once every 6 months, is it going to get the same therapeutic effect with reduced complications?
What about the new agents that are coming out that are bone protective? Would you anticipate, for example, denosumab, would you anticipate that it would cause this problem, or has it been looked at?
It's being looked at. In fact, I'm one of the consultants in their particular study, at least an adjudicator of any potential cases. Denosumab has the advantage of being a monoclonal antibody, which is reversible. The real problem with bisphosphonates is their long half-life and their accumulation in bone. Now, our particular research that has been very fruitful in the oral bisphosphonates is the serum CTX. Now, the serum CTX is very useful in the oral bisphosphonates because it is not clouded literally by the cancer itself. We have seen the CTX not correlate well with multiple myeloma. We see it correlate very well with osteoporosis and oral bisphosphonates. Right now, we don't know, but we're doing a study to see how well CTX testing correlates with metastatic breast cancer.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.